My name is Lata Krishnan, Chair of the American India Foundation and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. At this time, we would like to welcome and thank members of the Northern California Peace Corps Association. Tonight's program is being hosted by the American India Foundation and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. AIF is one of the largest American nonprofits focused on development in India. AIF invests in high-impact investments in education, livelihoods, public health, and leadership development, and has improved the lives of 2.5 million marginalized people in India. For anyone interested about development of the underprivileged in India, please get in touch with us and visit our website at www.aif.org. The Commonwealth Club of California is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum. We bring over 450 annual events on topics ranging across politics, culture, society, and the economy to more than 20,000 members throughout the Bay Area. Please visit our website at www.commonwealthclub.org for more info. During our program, we will have time for your questions. We encourage you to write them on the question cards, as members of our staff and volunteers will be collecting them throughout the program. The Commonwealth Club is proud to podcast and broadcast a number of our programs on KQED FM 88.5 on Fridays at 8 p.m. and KLIV AM 1590 on Thursdays at 7 p.m. We kindly ask that all cell phones be silenced at this time. At this time, I'll pause for a brief moment as we will begin recording tonight's program. Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the American India Foundation and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Lata Krishnan. It is my pleasure to introduce Somini Sengupta, author of The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. Somini is the United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She was born in Calcutta and grew up in Canada and California. She received her degree in English and Development Studies from UC Berkeley and studied politics at Oxford University. Somini joined the New York Times in 2003 as a foreign correspondent, covering everything from child soldiers and civil war in the Congo to the receding glaciers in the Himalayas. She has held bureau chief postings in Dakar and New Delhi and covered technology and law in the U.S. In 2004, she received the George Polk Award for Outstanding International Reporting. Moderating this evening's program is Alison Van Degelen, BBC contributor and host of Fresh Dialogues. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Somini Sengupta and Alison Van Degelen.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Can you all hear me okay? Okay, good. My name is Somini. I was born in India, as many of you know. I left when I was quite small, and there are not a lot of memories that I have of my childhood there, but there are some that have really stayed planted in my brain. They may not be perfect memories, but there's one of my grandfather, who was a complete and total news junkie. He had a transistor radio on the windowsill next to his bed. It was turned on to All India Radio day and night. He had a stack of newspapers on his table. And as I was just learning how to read, I must have been maybe seven, about the same age as my daughter is now, he was beginning to lose his eyesight. He was starting to go blind. And I remember being summoned into his room and being ordered to read a few things. So maybe I could manage a headline, maybe one paragraph, the first paragraph of a story. I had absolutely no idea what any of it meant, but I knew that it meant something to him, because at the end of every day, when the heat of the day subsided, he would go outside, he would sit on his stoop, And all his friends from the neighborhood would come around, you know, some of them with their canes, all in varying states of frailty, and they would come and they would sit on that stoop and they would argue about the day's news. So they would argue about who was going to war in which country, and which politician was a swindler, and why was the price of vegetables and lentils going up at the market. They would talk, they would argue, and then when it got dark, they would all get up and go home, and the same thing would happen the next day. So for me, you know, as a kid watching this, I knew that the world beyond my grandfather's stoop was a vast and interesting world that I wanted to explore. And I knew that the news mattered. And perhaps it was then that, you know, a small seed may have planted itself in my brain because I grew up to be a newspaper woman. I grew up to be a journalist, and I came back almost exactly 30 years after I left. I came back in 2005 as the bureau chief for the New York Times. And almost instantly, I realized how young this country had become. Not just young in the sense that there were a lot of children, because, you know, there were always a lot of children in India. In fact, India's fertility rate has gone down quite dramatically since independence. And so, you know, the population as a whole has fewer children to take care of, fewer older people to take care of relative to the rest of the population. And really what's happened is that this working age cohort has just really bulged. And so I'll give you what to me is a mind-boggling number. The number of Indians between the ages of 15 and 34 today exceed 420 million. Now, that exceeds the combined population of the United States, Canada, and Britain. I mean, it's astonishing. Every month, 1 million Indians turn 18, so they can go out looking for work, they can register to vote, many of them are embracing the internet for the first time in their lives, they're speaking out, they're falling in love, they're coming of age, and in so doing, I think they're really transforming the soul of Indian democracy. And so I set out to explore what this generation of young Indians were all about. That's what I set out to do in the book. And so the book kind of became a portrait of three generations, if you will. It was my father's generation. He was born right before independence. He is what's known as Midnight's children. A little bit my generation, because I kept thinking of who I might have become had I stayed in India. And my generation would have been the one just before the economic reforms began. And the heart of this book is really what I call Noonday's children. And Noonday's children are those who come of age after 1991, after the Indian economy slowly, quietly begins to open up, and it leads to all kinds of profound changes. So if you'll bear with me, I'll tell you just a couple of stories about the people that I write about. One of them is a young man named Anupam. And Anupam I met when he was 17 years old. Anupam is the son of an auto rickshaw driver from a tough North Indian town called Patna. Anupam's father, 6-7 days a week, 12 hours a day, drove one of those three-wheeled auto rickshaws throughout the city of Patna. Anupam not only did not want to be an auto rickshaw driver, he wanted to get into one of the toughest universities in the world, the Indian Institutes of Technology, which many of you in this room would know. And what made Anupam's ambition all the more improbable was that the schools in his neighborhood, both the government schools and the private schools that his parents could afford, I mean, they didn't work. The teachers didn't show up to teach. He remembers in the government school the bricks tumbling down from the schoolhouse. The electricity didn't work in his neighborhood half the day. There was a ribbon of, you know, sewage running down, raw sewage running down each end of his lane. And Anupam didn't let any of that stop him. Anupam dropped out of school in fourth grade, came home and told his mother that His teacher wasn't reading properly from the textbook that she was teaching from. And he came home and he said, I'm going to study by myself. And his mother never once doubted him. His mother never said, go back to that school or go work in a factory or do housework. I mean, of course, he was the eldest son. She would never say do housework. She completely believed in him. She had no idea what the IITs were, but it didn't matter. She believed in him. And so, spoiler alert, Anupam did make it. He did make it. He cut a hole through the fence. He literally cut his own hole through the fence, and he crawled right through. He stepped right through to the other side. And when he did, when he got to the other side, he began a kind of discovery of India for himself and slowly came to get to know himself better, but also he got to know his country better. And he came to discover how his country had deprived so many young men and women like himself. I tell you the story of Anupam not because Anupam is typical. He is an extraordinary young man. I've known him now for 10 years. He is he's a man of remarkable resilience, remarkable persistence. I tell you the story because his aspiration is the story of so many Indians and so many young Indians of his generation. I tell you his story because his story is the story of a golden child. You know, every family has a golden child. And the story of a mother who really believes in him. So, if there's one country that I have found myself comparing India to again and again, it is not China. I mean, many of you will have heard the commonplace comparisons of India and China. I actually think that comparison is quite limited. India and China storylines are very, very different. But India and the United States, we have remarkably parallel trajectories. Why do I say that? Because we are both really unlikely democracies. We are not based on a single ethnicity or a single religion. We are both incredibly diverse countries. We are also born of profound, degrading forms of inequality. In America, chattel slavery is very much part of our history. In India, the caste system is very much part of our history. And yet, remarkably, we both have these constitutions that guarantee, that promise, equality in the eyes of the law. That's an extraordinary thing. And I think for both countries, the journeys have been precisely to realize that promise. In fits and starts, not in a straight line, not always in pretty ways, but as you see in this country, Black Lives Matter is very much about realizing that promise made in the Constitution. There's one pillar of Indian democracy that I would argue has been pretty wobbly from the very beginning, and that is the right to free expression, the right to free speech. Because India, unlike any other country in the world, has had to balance these two things. On the one hand, the constitutionally guaranteed right to free speech. On the other hand, the chance that something someone says or paints or posts online can really upset a community based on their religion, based on their caste group, their ethnic group, and then it can lead to unrest. And as you know, India has had many bouts of communal unrest. So for India's leaders from the very beginning, this has been a really delicate balancing act. But I do think that this has become so much sharper in the internet age. And this is a really profound challenge for India today. One of the stories I tell is of a young woman, her name is Renu, and she gets arrested a few years ago for posting something online. And she gets arrested under a provision of the law that criminalizes online speech if it can spark unrest offline. And so Renu kind of becomes a test case of this a few years ago, and it infuriates the members of her generation when she is arrested and charged with a criminal offense for a Facebook post. And ultimately, the charges against Renu are dropped. The law under which she was arrested is overturned by India's Supreme Court. But the story doesn't end there. I think this is a really significant and urgent fault line of Indian democracy today. And many of you will have been following the news just in the last couple of weeks of some protests that have been going on in Delhi, in the heart of the capital, at a university called Jawaharlal Nehru University. It's like the Berkeley of India. And it's extremely prestigious. There were some student protests there a few weeks ago, at which some slogans were shouted for Kashmiri independence. And the student leader there stood up for his fellow students' right to free speech. Shortly after that, he was arrested, not under a new law, but an old law, a colonial-era law, and charged with sedition. And his arrest and what has ensued after that has really just revealed what a polarizing issue this is for Indian society today. And it's not necessarily old versus young. You know, it has polarized young Indians on these lines, between those who say that unpatriotic speech should be punished and those who say that the very fabric of a healthy democracy relies on the ability of students, especially students, to express their views, their political views. There's one last story that I will tell you about, and that is of a young woman named Varsha. And Varsha I met when she was 14 years old. She's the daughter of a presswala. Her parents have a small stand in a prosperous suburb. They press other people's clothes. And so ever since Varsha was a little girl, she's been carrying bundles of clothes from people's apartments and nice houses. She's helped her mother iron the clothes. She's carried them back. And because she's the oldest girl of five siblings, she also helps her mother every night with making chapatis. She helps her siblings with their homework. She does all of this, but she is totally and utterly devoted to school. She's nuts about school. Why? Because school is her exit ticket. She does not want to be a presswala. She does not want to be a presswala's wife. What does Varsha want to be? Varsha wants to be a police officer. She wants to wear a khaki, pressed, starched uniform with the, you know, silver stars on her lapel, the handcuffs on the belt loops. And she wants to be a police officer because when Varsha was about 16 years old, another young woman, slightly older than her, was brutally gang raped on the streets of Delhi, and you've all heard about this case. And Varsha wanted to serve her country. Varsha wanted to be a police officer to keep women and girls like her safe. Now, Varsha's father, he loved her. He totally backed her. He knew that she was a special kid, and he wanted her to get an education because he knew that an educated girl would find a better match. She would be able to find her a better husband if she got a good education. But while he was her champion, he was also the defender of the very rules that circumscribe girls like Varsha. And so while he wanted her to get an education, he was wary of too much education. He was of mixed minds about her working outside the home and certainly absolutely opposed to the idea of her becoming a police officer. And so Varsha pushed and nudged and pushed and nudged her father. And the story of Varsha is really the story. It's an unfinished story. She's still only 19 years old. But Varsha's story is really a story of a young woman who tries to grow her wings, and of her father who has to decide how far he's going to let her go. So thank you very much for listening. Am I here?
Yes, okay.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming out on this very rainy evening in Silicon Valley. And so many thank you for coming from New York to be with us tonight. I'm looking forward to a very lively conversation, and we do invite your questions from the audience. So I'd like to start. Your book is all about the end of karma, and it's also called The Hope and Fury of India's Youth. Let's talk tonight. What I'd like to do is explore that hope and that fury, but I'd like to start with the fury part so we can end on a hopeful note. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about that? So let's talk about that fury. One of the points that you made in your opening remarks was that amazing statistic. Every month, 1 million Indians turn 18. Talk about what you call that youth bulge and the implications for that furious part of India's mm-hmm. future.
Mm-hmm. The youth bulge, first of all, just to put it in context a little bit, at a time when the world is aging, particularly the rich world is aging, India is home to more young people than any other country in the world at any point in human history. I mean, this is a real historic concentration of young people. And the challenge of meeting their expectations for economic opportunities, that is a staggering challenge. An example of fury that some of you may have heard about recently in the state of Haryana, which is a prosperous state next to Delhi, there were some protests a few weeks ago, and it was they were described as caste protests. They were led by a prosperous, land-owning caste called the Jats. And the sons of the Jats no longer can survive on the land, and they are no longer, they're not educated enough to get good jobs, the kinds of jobs that they would like. And so they were agitating for reservations or quotas, set-asides in government jobs. And they blocked the streets for several days. They burned some cars and trucks and really dominated the newspapers for several days with pictures of that kind of fury. Now, India is too big and too vast for there to be just that one story, you know. So I do not want to say that it's typical of what's happening all over the country. It's simply impossible to make that kind of a generalization. But that is certainly an example of the immediate fury that you see on the streets.
Right. And for people that are not as familiar as you are with this caste system, can you explain what that means and the implications? And then I'd also like to talk about this whole idea of quotas, because that seems to be a very timely issue right now. Mm-hmm. People are demanding quotas for mm-hmm. various castes, is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, caste remains an important social unit. It has lost much of its original currency. It no longer strictly defines what someone does for a living. It is very important in how people vote. It is very important in who they marry, by and large. There are, of course, exceptions. And the whole issue of reservations goes back to the original, to the early days, when it was very clear that if there was going to be anything like a level playing field, those caste groups that had been long marginalized, who were outcasts, who were Dalits, and also indigenous people, Adivasis, there were reservations for them written into the law. So reservations for them in educational institutions, reservations for them in government jobs. That has expanded, and the number of castes that are entitled to, or other communities that are entitled to reservations, has steadily expanded. And it tends to vary from state to state, but what you were seeing in this North Indian state of Haryana, the protest that I was just talking about, was a demand for even a greater expansion of reservations. But interestingly enough, not for a community that had been historically oppressed, but for a community that was historically quite privileged.
Right. And when you talk about caste, you actually told a short story in your book about a very famous and well-respected musician who goes into a posh hotel in India, and they will not serve him. And that, to me, was a shock. Can you describe what happened and why that happened in today's modern India?
Yeah, this story was told to me by a dear friend of mine who is a concert promoter, and he promotes the music of Rajasthan, the sort of traditional music of Rajasthan. And he was taking one of his musicians, a very famous musician who had won lots of national awards, and he was taking him to perform, and he invited him to his fancy hotel for a cup of tea beforehand. And this is a very traditional part of the country where some of these social customs are observed more strictly than in many other parts of the country. And this musician was not served a cup of tea because the waiter who came to serve said, "No, we don't serve Manganyars. That's the community that he belonged to." And my friend was appalled and summoned the hotel manager. And the hotel manager stuck by the waiter and said, "Well, he's absolutely right. We have certain customs here, and we don't serve him." And so my friend, who happens to be a travel agent, then said, "Well, then I will not recommend that anyone come and stay in your hotel." It was an example of how, in some places, certainly not all, how some of these prohibitions still survive.
They're deeply entrenched in the community. And do you see that changing?
Oh, I think it's already changed remarkably. I mean, if you go to a restaurant, you know, in any small city or town, you don't know who you're eating with or who is serving you or who's preparing
you. So that's really an outlier experience, you would say.
That was unusual, but it struck me because it happened in such a, you know, fancy and seemingly modern, yes, hotel with all the amenities, yeah.
Right. Well, one of the other factors that you write about in your book that leads to this fury is the gender imbalance in India. Can you explain what it is, what this gender imbalance is, and why you feel this could lead to more fury, more violence?
The share of Indian boys to girls is imbalanced, so much so that it is worse today than at any point in India's history. Let me correct that. The last couple of years have shown a slight improvement in the numbers. But as ultrasound technology has become more widely available, people can afford it, girls are culled from the population. So much so that among, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, there are 17 million extra boys among Indians between the ages of 10 and 24. That's a lot of extra boys. And many of them, in many parts of the country where the gender imbalance is particularly high, young men have a very hard time finding a wife. And so, for example, in Haryana, that's the state with the worst gender imbalance, in fact. And so it didn't surprise me that those protests that we just discussed were so fierce in that state, because the marriage market is extremely competitive where you have so few women.
Yes,
and
talk
so
about
a man
a
without a job.
Yes, you talk about a bachelor gap.
A man without a job is going to have a much harder time finding a wife. And this is a society where marriage is really important. So I do think that there is something to look at very closely, what the implication of this surplus, of this male surplus, is going to be on all kinds of things, including on violence, and including on violence against women.
Right. And you also write that, I mean, violence is not just a male...
province.
Province, that's the word.
Right.
There's an incredible chapter, it made my jaw drop, and it's called Gorilla Paying for Broken Promises. And you described, is it Raki?
Raki.
And she's a 21-year-old female commander of a gorilla squad. And she's actually killed several people with her bare hands. She's part of an extreme communist group fighting against the state to return power to the people. And you talk in your book about people in this area, they know what is out there because of modern technology. They know what they've been denied for generations, and they're taking their destinies into their own hands, except, you write, it's fueled more by nihilism than by hope. Can you tell us a little more about her story?
Yeah, that's a chapter that has a lot of fury. It's a chapter about the Maoist insurgency, which first emerged in a really big way in the late 60s, when there were Maoist movements in many parts of the world. But what I found really striking is when I came back to India in 2005, this was, you know, such a prosperous time. This was a golden age for India. And the Maoists had come up again. You know, this insurgency was thriving again. And where was it thriving? It was thriving in precisely that part of India that had been most left behind by the years of economic growth. And it was thriving in the Adivasi belt. Adivasis are India's indigenous people. They live in some of the richest lands. So their lands are full of natural resources, timber, iron ore, coal, all kinds of minerals. And the Adivasi belt is also home to the poorest people in India. And some of them, absolutely, have left their villages and have seen what life is like, you know, in the other parts of India. And they know exactly how their home communities are deprived. And this woman who I met, she was from West Bengal, from a small village, kind of not far from the city where I was born. And she was an ordinary peasant woman, and she kind of got, you know, lured into the movement, and she became a different person. She learned to kill. And after a few years, she got really worn out, and she got really disillusioned, and at great risk, she ran away. She knew that if she went home to her mother's house, not only was she going to be dead, her mother was going to be killed as well, and she knew that if she ran away to the police, she turned herself into the police might kill her as well. But she took that very tough decision. She decided to run away to the police. She turned herself in, and I met her when she was sort of in an unofficial witness protection program. And, you know, I just wanted to hear her story. And remarkably, her stories just poured out of her. And I have to say that many of us don't really know much about the indigenous belt in India. You know, I certainly didn't. I didn't know much about the Adivasi history. But I think these parts of the country are going to be more and more important to pay attention to. Not for the Maoist movement alone, which has been very destructive, but because these are the parts of the country that still need electricity. The Adivasi belt is among the 300 million people who don't have any connection to the grid, who are not connected to the grid at all. But also, it's where the environmental damage, the ecological damage, has been grave and stands to be much graver in the coming years as India expands coal mining and power generation. So I do think it's a very important part of the country for all of us to pay greater attention to.
Absolutely. And you also describe the story of a young girl called Mani, and she becomes a maid in an affluent Delhi suburb. And you describe the her cousin being kidnapped and eventually found. And you describe this as one story of human trafficking. And you write, the trafficking has seen a rise steadily in the last 15 years as more urban Indians prosper, move out of extended family homes, and fuel the demand for maids. As you write that, I was struck by how it seems inevitable. Do you feel it's inevitable? It's just part of this shift from rural to urban, that there's going to be more human trafficking?
I don't think it's inevitable at all. I think men and women can choose to work, including in domestic work. It should be their choice, just as it is in our country. There are, unfortunately, no labor laws that protect the rights of most domestic workers in India, and so some of the conditions under which they work and some of the abuse that they face can be quite shocking. But I wrote this story in part to draw attention to the woman who is the center of this story is a woman named Supriya. And Supriya is a stay-at-home mom in a prosperous suburb in Gurgaon. She lives in a nice gated community. And Supriya is the woman I might have been. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a really conscientious woman. She's well-educated. She knows about the world. She's a devoted mother. She gets very briefly, for a moment, drawn into the lives of other mothers in a remote part of the country, in the Adivasi belt, because her nanny, who lives with her, comes to her and says, my niece, I think, has been abducted and brought somewhere here to work against her will in Delhi, and I don't know what to do, and will you help me find her? And Supriya jumped in and began to help her nanny find her, and in so doing, as I write, opened a door that most of us are used to keeping closed. And she opened the door briefly. She sort of stepped into the lives of other mothers, but then quickly had to close that mm-hmm. door. And so the exercise is a very tricky one. It's seeing distress, but not seeing distress. It's having to help the people who work for you because there is no social safety net. There is no one else that they can go to. And I think it's important. I wrote that story because I think it is a measure of the moral challenge of living with inequality, profound inequality. And that is a moral challenge that we are increasingly facing in this country. So I wrote it mainly to explore some of the parallels that I was seeing between our two countries. Again, I mean, as I was writing this book, I just kept being struck by all of these ways in which our lives here and lives there have such lessons.
Yes, this passage particularly resonated with me from that chapter. And you write, the psychic costs of living in privilege in America and India are different. We Americans have mastered the art of walling ourselves off completely from the lives of others. In India, it's much harder. It requires an entirely different calibration of compassion and its lack. That's a beautiful passage. Mm. It really resonated with me. But talk about what India is doing about helping those in extreme poverty. You cite some studies that were done on helping the extreme poor in India versus China and Brazil. Can you talk a little bit about that? Obviously, you're the journalist. You're not the economist expert. But I think there are some lessons to be had from what you explored.
Right. And the economists in this room must forgive me because I'm sure that I'm going to simplify it far too much to your liking. But there was a very interesting study done of these three countries, all of whom had shown
tremendous economic growth during a particular time span. I forget now what years the study was referring to, but it was during, in each country, during the period of sharp economic expansion. And it found very different patterns. It found that in China, poverty declined sharply, inequality expanded quite sharply. It found that in Brazil, poverty declined sharply, inequality did not, because Brazil had put in a cash transfer program. The study largely credited this cash transfer program, where the government gave cash grants to the very poor. It was often conditioned on some things, such as getting your children immunized, making sure that they stayed in school. So there were some conditions attached to it. In India, poverty declined not as fast as in China. Inequality grew quite measurably. So the reason I was interested and the reason I found this so revealing is that while economic expansion in India, there is no question that it has brought down poverty quite sharply. How fast has that happened is a matter of dispute, and what happens to the very poor, the poorest of the poor, remains really quite challenging. And remember, India is home to 1 in 3 poor people worldwide. So whatever India does to address extreme poverty, and extreme poverty is living on $1.25 a day, I mean, that's barely this side of the funeral pyre. Whatever India does to address extreme poverty will have huge impact on our global effort to reduce global poverty.
So talk about, I mean, a large part of that poverty, and you alluded to it earlier in your remarks, is the ticket to a better future, to ending the original karma, is education. Talk about the education system in India and how successful it is, because I think the figure you quote is around 70% literacy in the whole of India. Can you talk on that and what is being done, what is successful, mm-hmm. and what's not working? And the other issue is the cheating issue, of course, that seems to have reared its head again.
Well, first, let's keep the remarkable success. When my father was going to school in 1951, half of all Indian children were in school. Today, all Indian children are in primary school. It's like universal enrollment in primary school. And that is nothing short of historic, because you're talking about Dalits going to school, you're talking about girls going to school, many of them first-generation learners, the first in their families to go to school. And I'll just tell you a story. I remember going to a school in rural Bihar a few years ago, and very poor city, poor village near the border of Nepal. I'll never forget, it was a winter morning. It was very cold, very crisp, sunny. And I showed up to the village and just watched these streams of children just running and walking to the one village schoolhouse. And there again, good news. Every village has a schoolhouse. Every village. They were just streaming to the schoolhouse. They were carrying these empty rice sacks, these flattened rice sacks, because, of course, there weren't enough benches or chairs to sit on, and so they would flatten the rice sacks to sit on the ground, to sit on the patio and in front. And they all came, and the girls were wearing these, you know, kind of oversized dresses held up with safety pins. And I remember writing in my notebook, safety pins, and every village I went to like that, I would always see girls with dresses held up with safety pins. And they came to school, they sat on their rice sacks, they all opened up a variety of textbooks. There were supposed to be 5 teachers, 3 had shown up on time,
The headmaster, who was also a teacher, was completely overwhelmed. He said he had never seen this many students coming to school. He had no idea how to divide them up. He had no idea what to teach them. And as it happens, this is the case in many, many schools, because the organization that many of you will have heard of, Pratham, they do an annual assessment of what school children are learning, and they have found year after year that children who are in fifth grade, they have been in school for 5 years, their parents have sent them to school for 5 years, half of them are reading, can read a sentence from a second grade textbook. Half of them can subtract. The others can't. And I'll never forget what the social worker who took me to this village, at the end of that morning, he was incredibly dejected, and he said, you know, Didi, when they grow up, these children will curse us, because they'll say, we came to school every day and we learned nothing. And I think that's pretty profound. I mean, that stayed with me, in part because of this tremendous opportunity that we're talking about, you know, among these children who are rushing to school, whose parents have this very vague but profound notion that if I send my kid to school, I don't know what she or he is going to get out of it, but at least they will have a life that's better than mine. That is the hope on which parents are sending their children to school. And it's hard to imagine how India can fulfill its potential and how so many young Indians can fulfill their potential without having something like a level playing field, you know, just at that level, to learn how to read, to learn how to do math, just basic stuff so they can have some chance of, you know, getting work and realizing their expectations.
Yes, I was glad that you started your book with the first chapter, that story of hope of, mm-hmm.
of Anupam,
Anupam mm-hmm. Kumar. He's the son of a rickshaw driver, and he got himself, you know, a good education. He saw education as a ticket to reinventing himself, you know, really grasping this aspiration for a better future. And you write, he's an emblem of a profound psychic shift. There are millions like him who shake off the past and say, why not me? It's a wonderful story of hope. Do you feel, how representative do you feel he is? Do you think, can you give us a percentage? Is he a one percenter, or is it less than that even?
He is entirely exceptional because of his resilience, of his prodigy. He is absolutely representative in his hunger. He has fire in the belly. Certainly, I would not have been able to compete with the likes of Anupam, had I grown up in his generation. And I have to say, in telling the stories of these young people, the one thing that I kept being reminded of was, you know, I could have been any of these people that I write about, were it not for the accident of my birth. I could have been Anupam's mother, I could have been Varsha's mother, I could have been Rocky, the commander, the Maoist guerrilla commander who you speak of. I didn't tell Anupam's story because it's a Horatio Alger story. You know, as I write very specifically, his country is not a country of Horatio Algers, and this country, by the way, is not a country of Horatio Algers, because the evidence repeatedly points out that is indeed a myth. But I told the story of Anupam because he is sort of the exception that proves the rule, and also because his own transformation was remarkable. You know, his own overcoming his past. And that's what that's what I try to signal with the title of the book, The End of Karma, because all of them, in some ways, are trying to overcome their past.
And they are all people born with one destiny, trying to make another destiny. And in that sense, you know, it will echo to Americans too, I think.
Yes, the rags to riches. It's not as realistic as perhaps Horatio Alger wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a lot about it. But there's another great example, very high profile example. The Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi. He's a bit of a rags to riches story himself. Can you talk about him and his personal journey, and whether you feel you talk to a lot of people in India, I'm sure still, even though you're no longer the bureau chief, talk to us about what he has promised and how he is, what he's achieved so far in fighting corruption and getting a better education and leveling that playing field.
Narendra Modi's personal story is a remarkable story. He came from a very modest background and worked his way up through first the RSS then through the Bharatiya Janata Party and became prime minister. So his personal story is remarkable, and he cast himself as the very model of aspiration. That was his campaign in 2014, and it was a very effective campaign, in part because he held himself as a mirror to the aspirations of so many young people, and in part because the other political choices were clearly unsatisfactory to the majority of Indian voters. So he won with a historic mandate. His challenges are enormous. Creating jobs for somewhere between 10 and 17 million people every year. Let me rephrase that. By some economic projections, India needs to create somewhere between 10 and 17 million jobs every year. Not only that, it needs to prepare young people for those jobs. So we were just talking about the shortcomings of the education system. So it has to educate young people, give them the skills, the vocational skills that they need, prepare them to function in a modern economy. That is a staggering challenge. It is complicated by the fact that India cannot do so on the same path as other industrialized nations. Mr. Modi has repeatedly said that sustainability is in the Indian DNA. That may well be the case, but I think that we still have to see some evidence of what that means for this government. This government has certainly planned a very ambitious rollout of renewable energy, solar in particular, and yet its development of coal and coal-powered coal-fired power plants remains a very big part of the energy pie. That will inevitably increase air pollution perhaps become a political issue. You know, in cities like Delhi, which is consistently one of the most polluted cities in the world, the issue of air pollution and the livability of cities may indeed become a political challenge for local and national politicians. And I must say, the other challenge for Mr. Modi is precisely what I was talking about earlier, is, you know, the limits of dissent. There too, I think Mr. Modi and his government have to show that there can be space for political opinions of all kinds, and that rule of law will be followed. So I think these are some of the challenges that Mr. Modi is already facing. And we'll see some of this playing out in the next couple of years as crucial state elections approach. Look, it's not for me as a journalist to say which way India, nor for any of us in this country, I think. But these are the issues that Indians are engaging with, you know, at every level.
And that brings us to the issue of religious tolerance, intolerance. Talk on what Prime Minister Modi is, where he's placed, because he has a bit of a checkered background on that particular topic. And we have a question from the audience here. India is home to one of the largest Muslim populations. In today's world, with building tensions between the extreme Islamic groups and the West, what is the state of Indian Muslims? And why do we not hear much about Indian Muslims involved in extremism? Very good question.
So it is a good question. Look, there is no one Indian Muslim. You know, Indian Muslims are spread all over the country. They speak different languages. They have very different ambitions and political views. I will say that, you know, this has been a constant tension from the very beginning of India, right? What between the Hindu nationalist movement, who were active since before independence, who wanted a Hindu nation, and between those who have conceived of India as a secular country where religious freedom, you know, people are free to practice their own religions. These have been, you know, competing projects from the very beginning. It certainly is much more, it has been much more pronounced in certain periods of Indian history. Certainly in 1992, just as the economy was opening up, there was also this big political moment, right, when you had the movement for building a Ram temple at a 15th century mosque in Ayodhya, a very powerful political movement for that, which gave rise to the Bharatiya Janata Party. And now, with Mr. Modi's election to the highest office in the land, there have been some worrying developments. And I refer to the killing of Indian citizens on suspicion of slaughtering cattle. That is illegal in many parts of India. It is not everywhere in India. It is in some states, in many states. But I think a lot of Indians were given pause by, you know, the mob killings of people on suspicion of breaking the law. So, again, this is an issue that has to be worked out, you know, in Indian political debate. And there are elections every year, and Indian voters get a chance to express themselves. And they often, you know, if they elect one party to lead the nation and the central government, they will often try to balance that, you know, by electing another party at their state level election. And those crucial state elections are really coming up, and that's going to be a kind of bellwether for Indian politics. And might I just point out one more thing? Like, you know, because India is a democracy, it's not a flat authoritarian state, and because this country is a democracy and not a flat authoritarian state, we often have these moments where we have identity crises, right? I mean, that's what democracies have. They have to work that out. We have an election campaign that certainly shows what a moment of identity crisis we are in. You know, there's a presidential candidate who is proposing to keep out refugees on the basis of their religion. That is an identity crisis moment for our country, and India faces some similar ones.
Do you think Prime Minister Modi could be doing more?
That is not for me to say whether Prime Minister Modi can be doing more. Certainly, many of his citizens, including people who voted for him, believe that he should have taken action sooner and more strongly against members of his party and supporters of his party who have broken the law.
Right. Here's another question from the audience. There seems to be a huge increase in honor killing. Recently in Tamil Nadu, a couple were hacked to death in broad daylight in a public market. Why the sudden resurgence of honor killings? Can you comment on that?
You know, I honestly can't say if there is now a sudden resurgence or if we are hearing about it more. I do write about an honor killing in the book. And I write about it because it happens in the heart of Delhi. And the woman who is killed, the woman and her husband, they're killed. And the suspects, they're still pending trial. The suspects in this case are not some old men in a village somewhere, but the suspects in this case are her brother and her brother's friends, who are also growing up, you know, in the heart of Delhi. And what I found remarkable, though, about this story, I mean, it haunted me. It haunted me how this couple was brutally shot in the head, both of them. But it also brought a remarkable transformation in the surviving brother of the young man who was killed. He was a very traditional young man. He had had an arranged marriage. He lived with his parents. He didn't question any of these rules. But then his brother was killed for marrying the wrong woman. And he also had become a father right around that time to a little girl. And it led to his really questioning and rethinking, what are these rules that I've grown up with, and wanting a very different kind of country for his daughter. So he was a changed man, and so that for me was hope.
Right, there's the hope. You're always hope. Looking for
yeah.
the hope. In writing this book, have you experienced, again, a question from the audience, have you experienced any backlash from locals for writing about Indian issues as an American? My experience is that locals are remarkably thin-skinned to comments from non-Indians. Well, you're half Indian.
That's a very good question. I think, you know, Indian journalists are tough journalists, and Indian critics are tough critics. So I don't think there's any absence of, you know, vibrant, tough journalism going on in India. And, you know, look, I'm a daughter of India. My daughter is a daughter of India. I wanted to write this book to understand the country that made me and the country that made her. And I wanted to understand what kind of a future it might have. It is not for me to prescribe the direction in which the path that India takes. My quest in writing this book was to understand the country better and to understand better the place that I come from.
You're also right. This is the last question. We have to wrap it up shortly. But I thought this was very poetic. On your last page, you talk about this book being a love letter of sorts to your young daughter, who's turning 8 soon, I understand. What are your hopes for the sons and daughters of India? Get optimistic with us, mm-hmm. because we've spent a lot of time tonight talking about the challenges and mm-hmm. Conflicts in mm-hmm. India. But what is your dream, your hope?
You know, to those who, just to go back to the last question for one second, to those who wonder why I choose these stories, I would simply say because they're Indians too. You know, the woman from Jharkhand who comes to work as a maid, the woman from Bengal who becomes a Maoist, the Presswala's daughter, you know, they're ordinary Indians and their stories deserve to be told. If there is one thing that I have learned from writing this book, it is that it's important to take care of our young, and it's especially important to take care of our daughters. Because I think in their hands is our destiny.
Well, thank you so much, Somani, for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, Somani Sangupta.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the American India Foundation and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Somani Sengupta, United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times and author of The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. Alison Van Digelen, BBC contributor and host of Fresh Dialogues to our audience here in Santa Clara. And hope those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting is adjourned.